1959.
You can't play.
I can. You watch.
Nice shot.
1971.
Sulagong to serve. Quietly.
The ABC brings you the story of an icon.
I'm Roger Corley.
Yvonne Goolagong.
I know.
What the hell is going on?
You're here to play tennis.
Go, Gong!
While champions play the game.
She possesses a raw talent. That can't be taught.
Come on, Amy.
Legends change it.
First Aborigine to play on the centre court of Wimbledon.
Have you got what it takes to win this tournament?
Once you don't win.
That's what I'm here for.
Goolagong.
Don't let anyone tell you you're not good enough.
I won't.
Stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
From Wurundjeri country, I'm Lexi Junawick, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, as much of Australia prepares to swelter through an intense heatwave, local communities in flood-ravaged areas of North Queensland are bracing for major losses, with more rainfall on the way. You'll hear from Federal Minister for Emergency Management, Christy McBain.
Quite precarious here, and obviously speaking to a number of those producers, they're quite in shock, I think.
Then...
Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action, please.
Thousands of Elvis fans begin their annual pilgrimage to parks in New South Wales. We speak with the woman hoping to take the crown of the ultimate Elvis tribute artist contest during this year's festival. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Right now, a multi-day intense heatwave is starting to bake much of southern Australia, with every state and territory except Queensland under heatwave warnings. But in the Sunshine State, many locals are bracing for a different kind of wild weather this week, with monsoon conditions already dumping more than a metre of rain across parts of the north and northwest. Floodwaters have isolated some regions, with primary producers reporting more than 24,000 missing or deceased livestock. Yesterday, the state and federal governments announced an additional $38 million in disaster recovery funding. For more on this, host Barbara Miller spoke with Christy McBain, who's the Minister for Regional Development, Local Government and Emergency Management.
Now, you were touring with the Prime Minister and the Treasurer some of those flood-affected regions yesterday. What did you see? What did you hear?
Yeah, yesterday I was in Cloncurry and then Julia Creek, and I've met directly with a range of primary producers and our local council in particular in regards to impacts not only to infrastructure but obviously to our primary producers. You know, there are some significant losses, and I think the big concern is that we still don't know total number of losses, because at this stage we've still got water flowing, and with the forecast looking like there'll be further rain, those numbers could increase. So quite precarious here, and obviously speaking to a number of those producers, they're quite in shock, I think. And you know, they thought 2019 was, you know, kind of a once-in-a-lifetime event where there were a number of losses, and unfortunately for a number of them, it looks like there'll be similar losses or more. So that's quite concerning.
And where will that money go, the $38 million announced?
So yesterday we announced an uplift to our emergency fodder allocation. That'll go to $7 million and six different local government areas: Carpentaria, Cloncurry, Flinders, McKinlay, Richmond and Winton. We've also announced primary producer grants up to $75,000 across seven local government areas to help impacted farmers with that initial cleanup, including fence restoration and debris removal and those types of things. And those grants will be available through the Queensland Department of Primary Industries. We obviously announced a package of works for Cloncurry Airport, which has been the tarmac there ripped up because of this weather, and that's a necessary piece of infrastructure for the community. It brings in mining workers. It sees wrecks, planes land, but it also saw a number of primary producers use it for takeoff and landing, but to get in various supplies as well. So really important that we assist in getting that back up and running as soon as we can.
When he was visiting the region, the Queensland Premier, David Crisafulli, hit out the Bureau of Meteorology after discovering that more than 20 automatic flood monitoring stations on swelling rivers weren't or online. He said it was a matter of life and death for remote communities. Of course, there's been a lot of criticism of the BOM's new website. Is it up to the task this summer?
Yeah, look, it's really important that we get to the bottom of some of these flood gauges. A lot of them are owned by local councils and state government entities, or they're owned by private companies, but it's really important that they're online and working. That's why in the 2023-24 budget, our government allocated over $200 million to upgrade and maintain a number of flood gauges across the country. I think it's really important for communities that there is a single owner and someone that, you know, can monitor that they are working and the community can rely on them. We've already, through an $8 million package, upgraded about 180 rain gauges, flood gauges and rain towers across North Queensland and Northwest Queensland with the former Queensland government. But it's really important that these things are maintained and kept up to date. I know that it is really important for people to have access to accurate information as soon as possible. So we're doing some work on that already.
But is the BOM fit for purpose? You've flagged that there does need to be a change in the culture and the approach of the organisation.
Oh, look, I think that the Bureau are doing a really complex job. You know, I spoke to a number of primary producers yesterday who were relying on the information that BOM was sending out, and they appreciated that information and believed it helped them move livestock quicker than they would have been able to otherwise.
You don't have concerns about the BOM website?
I think there's always ways in which we can look at improving things, and I think my colleague, the Minister for Environment, has been really clear with BOM that the expectation in our community is that they want to be able to rely on that website, and that's been relayed to BOM as well.
Christy McBain, Minister for Regional Development, Local Government and Emergency Management. And you can stay across all the latest emergency warnings for your area by tuning into your local ABC radio station. Turning overseas, and overnight, European leaders gathered in Paris to progress talks on a peace deal for Ukraine. In what must have been a slightly awkward moment, seated at the table was Denmark's Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, and across the table, the US envoys, Steve Witkoff, and Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. The gathering took place following renewed and emphatic statements by the US president that he's intent on taking control of Greenland, an autonomous territory of Denmark. European leaders have rallied behind Denmark and Greenland, issuing a statement saying Greenland is part of NATO. Security in the Arctic must therefore be achieved collectively in conjunction with NATO allies, including the United States. For further analysis on the situation, Barbara spoke with Jamie Shea. He is a former NATO official who is now a professor of strategy and security at the University of Exeter.
Is Mette Frederiksen exaggerating when she says a US takeover of Greenland would bring about the end of NATO?
Well, whether it would be the actual end of the alliance, of course, we don't know, but it would certainly hollow out NATO and make it into a far less cohesive and effective alliance than it's been, because it would be an instance of one NATO ally attacking the territory of another NATO ally, when the whole purpose of NATO, of course, is solidarity of allies against external threats like Russia. So it would certainly create probably NATO's biggest crisis in history. And whether it would lead to the immediate collapse of NATO, I'm not sure, but it would certainly push the Europeans much faster down the road where they're going already, which is to try to spend more on their own defence, invest more in their own defence capabilities and weapons, and try to reduce their dependency on the United States.
Do you think that's part of the tactic from Donald Trump in making these threats?
No, I don't, because to some degree, Trump has already succeeded in that venture when at the NATO summit in The Hague last July, he persuaded the Allies to increase their defence budgets from 2% of GDP to 5% of GDP, which is a massive hike. So this notion of the Europeans stepping up and the US doing less has been around NATO for some time already. And I don't think the Greenland thing is really connected to that at all. It strikes me that Trump wants Greenland because he wants to enlarge the United States, the US sphere of influence. And he obviously talks about it more in economic terms, in terms of getting a grip on some of Greenland's precious metals and oil and gas reserves, similar to what he said in Venezuela about the US taking over control of Venezuela's oil industry.
Do you think this is part of his new national security vision, where Greenland is essentially part of what he is now calling America's hemisphere, our hemisphere?
Yes, very, very much so. I think that's part of it. And of course, Trump has been speaking about Greenland not in isolation, but in connection with pressure on Colombia, recently pressure on Argentina to elect, in inverted commas, the right president, i.e. the pro-Trump candidate, pressures on Mexico, Colombia, Panama, a large number of other countries in the hemisphere as well. But Trump also seems to sort of believe that Greenland is in danger of falling under the influence of Russia or China because they have a few more ships in the Arctic these days than they did in the past, and that somehow Greenland is sort of vulnerable and undefended. This is simply not true. Greenland is part of NATO's integrated defence system. The Europeans send military forces there from time to time. The US already has a military base on Greenland. And so the idea that somehow NATO and Europe are neglecting Greenland's defence and therefore the United States has to step in strikes me as a little bit overblown, quite frankly.
Nevertheless, it would certainly send a strong signal to Russia, to China, were there to be some kind of enhanced US presence there.
Well, we have to remember that the US had a lot more troops and forces in Greenland during the Cold War than today. It used to have, in the Cold War years, 17 bases and facilities, and it was not at the request of Denmark that the US closed those bases or withdrew its forces. It was because Washington decided the situation in Greenland didn't really merit more than an American sort of strategic radar post and a few troops. And the Danes and NATO have never been opposed to the United States putting more forces in Greenland. This is provided for already under a bilateral security agreement, defence agreement between Copenhagen and Washington. And the Europeans and NATO have said, look, you know, Mr. Trump, if there really is a vacuum in the high north vis-a-vis Russia and China, you know, let's work on it together. Let the Europeans participate in that. So, in other words, what Trump is proposing is a solution for which there really isn't a problem. It's integrated into NATO, and Trump doesn't have to send military forces to occupy the territory in order to increase its defence and Western defence in the North Atlantic.
Jamie Shea, though, the fact that Mette Frederiksen is now talking about a threat to the very fabric of NATO would suggest, would it not, that she is increasingly worried about the rhetoric from Donald Trump?
Well, yes, obviously, because it's never comfortable for one head of state to be on the receiving end of all of this hostile rhetoric from another head of state when you're meant to be allies. And it's particularly grueling for a country like Denmark, which has always been a very loyal, particularly loyal ally to the United States in NATO. As I said, giving the US the basing facilities in Greenland. Denmark is choosing. Has been purchasing a lot of US military equipment recently as it increases its defense budget. The Danes recently signed an agreement with the American Air Force so that the American Air Force can also have more access to bases in Denmark. So when you think that you're doing everything you possibly can to show you're a loyal ally and to please Washington, it's particularly obviously grueling and egregious that you then have all of these pressures to take over a part of your sovereign territory.
Jamie Shea, former NATO official, now Professor of Strategy and Security at the University of Exeter. Staying overseas, and Colombia is another one of several countries potentially in an apparently emboldened Donald Trump's sights following the capture of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. Another country is Cuba, which the US president says is ready to fall. John Bonfilio is a Latin American correspondent based in Mexico. Barbara spoke with him.
John, Cuba is arguably the nation which has suffered the biggest blow from Nicolas Maduro's removal. Just explain the close ties between Venezuela and Cuba.
Yeah, the Trump administration's line on Cuba is that they believe it is ready to fall, and socially and economically, they may well be right. Politically is another matter, given the grip that the Communist Party continues to have on the island. The reason that Venezuela and Cuba are so closely linked, of course, is politically. They have sort of famously have sort of hard socialist communist regimes, but in particular, it relates to the support that Venezuela has given to Cuba with subsidized fuel over the period of the last generation. And of course, as of a month ago, when the so-called quarantine, the embargo on Venezuelan oil took place, that fuel has already dried up. And then you multiply that by the fact that Cuba was already on a cliff edge with a devastated economy, huge external migration, and almost nobody left alive who remembers the motivations for the 1959 revolution, which is now a history piece. And Cuba is, very distinctly at a point of inflection, I think.
The former vice president, of course, Delcy Rodriguez, has now been formally sworn in as Venezuela's interim president. Do you think she's going to offer any support to Havana?
It's an interesting political trade-off that Delcy Rodriguez, if she is going to toe the line, as is currently expected with the United States, is going to have to give up an awful lot. There's not very much which Cuba can offer her that would make the sort of the Cuba card, the Cuban support, particularly important for Venezuela. So it's very possible that of the things that she gives up, the support for Cuba is likely to be top amongst that list.
And turning to another country in the region, we alluded to it there, Colombia. Do you think US action in Colombia is likely?
This is fascinating, because one of the things which especially irked Trump about Maduro was actually Maduro's rhetorical pushback, which we saw a little bit also at the hearing in New York on Monday. And now that Maduro's gone, the next greatest point of resistance in this regard is Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, who not only criticised the action that took place in Venezuela and sort of drew it out as an action against Latin America as a whole, but also has been directly goading Trump. Petro famously was once a guerrilla, leftist guerrilla himself. He renounced violence, but on Monday he said that in the case of any US action, he would once again pick up a weapon. Colombia, of course, is the world's largest producer of cocaine, but Petro is not in any way, as Trump alleges, involved in cocaine production, but all of which makes the chances of, I wouldn't necessarily say a military strike into Colombia, but ongoing focus on what Trump regards as the Colombian problem, I think is fairly definite and inevitable.
There are reports that Nicolas Maduro was offered some kind of deal. Perhaps he could have found sanctuary in Turkey, for example. Do you think the Trump administration would consider some kind of offer like that to get rid of Gustavo Petro?
I think what's interesting now is we can't undo what took place over the weekend. And Trump knows it and the world knows it. So he has those actions and he has those consequences now as leverage. So any sort of quid pro quos that might have been offered prior to Saturday, the 3rd of January, are now very unlikely. Now the US administration, as we see across the airwaves, as we see with Greenland as well, very, very presently in the international news cycle, now the administration's sort of focus and leverage is entirely about saying, you do what we want or else.
Another way he might try and influence Colombia would be to get involved in some way in the elections coming up later this year. Tell us how much you think that is likely.
Yeah, almost certainly. And actually, I think it's important to note that if we that seeing the US action in Venezuela as the first US engagement in the sort of new Monroe Doctrine and radical reshaping of the Americas is something of a mistake. What we sort of have to realize is that this new administration wants to place the hemisphere in its economic service. It's exclusively a matter of sort of extractivist profit for American companies, and that Trump has already, will, and interchangeably use political and economic and military might in order to achieve this. And we've been seeing this throughout the course of the last 12 months. It's just that the world has suddenly woken up to the stark action that took place 72 hours ago and suddenly thinks that this is a whole different ball game that we're engaged in. But actually, for anybody paying attention in the Americas for the last few months, it's been fairly clear which way this is already going. And electoral interference, in inverted commas, if you like, has undoubtedly been one of the strategies.
John Bonfilio, Latin American correspondent based in Mexico there. Back home now, thousands of Elvis fans and tribute artists are descending on parks in central New South Wales for the annual festival dedicated to the King of Rock and Roll. Among those tribute artists is Maria Phillips, who also goes by the name Platinum Elvis. Barbara spoke with her and was even treated to a special impromptu performance. Take a listen.
Tell us, why are you an Elvis tribute act?
I have had a lifelong love of the King since I was 3 years of age.
Three's pretty young. Somebody must have been playing his songs to you.
Yes, the family. I was very close to my grandmother, and she had me watching Elvis movies on repeat and Elvis concerts. And the family was very into music, from a sort of Polish background, loved singing. And then I started mimicking Elvis in front of the TV, and it led for a love of singing and et cetera, et cetera. So, it's stayed with me since then in various guises.
Alongside your love of Elvis, you established a corporate career. You've held some senior positions. What's more nerve-wracking, handing down the end-of-year results or jumping in your Elvis jumpsuit to belt out one of his hits?
Yeah, I mean, it's all hard. I think anyone who performs, I don't think there are many people on the planet that don't get sort of last-minute nerves and stress. I would say this competition is probably up there with nerves because, yeah, it's very important to me, and I'm new to the official ETA scene. But, it's I thrive, I suppose, in these kind of scenarios.
Well, in preparation for that competition, could we possibly encourage you to give us a few bars? Would you be up for that?
I'm up for that. I'll give you a little bit of a song that's topical for the festival, Love Me Tender.
Thank you.
Here we go. Love me tender, love me sweet, never let me go. You have made my life complete, and I love you so. Love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfilled. For my darling, I love you, and I always will.
Whoa.
There you go, serenaded.
Beautiful, Barbara. Well, surely performing with backing track is going to be way easier than what you've just done. tell me how you are preparing for the competition.
The lyrics and the vocals, I guess I'm just repeats it, doing the song on repeat. I go through a process. I'm a bit of a process.
Sorry, this song is, which one? Are you singing Love Me Tender in the competition?
No, I'm not. I probably won't talk about on air what my competition song is, but they're songs that I love. I just decided I'm singing songs that I love. I've performed them before. It's just a case of remembering, to perform it the way that you should be performing it on stage. So I go through a process. I actually learn a song in a studio. I sort of have a process to do that. Then I'm really focused on Elvis's phrasing, which is really unique and really hard. I don't think anyone will ever get it right. So I do that. And then the second step is then try and watch Elvis performing it as much as I can so I can channel his moves and energy. Again, that's very hard. I think it will take me years to get to the level I want to get, and then bring my own bit of performance to the equation, I guess. So yes, I'll be in my place in Parks doing a few run-throughs between now and Friday, and I'm actually performing the song a couple of times live. So hopefully that will take a bit of pressure off.
The Platinum Elvis, Maria Phillips. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Barbara Miller and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josephine Asher. I'm Lexi Junewick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back with The Wrap the same time tomorrow.